Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, joined by actually a couple of guys I've just been hanging with in Vegas, though I wish I would say that was some kind of relaxing weekend of gambling, but it wasn't. The first of which is Mark Christensen. How are you, Mark?
Good, Mike. Good to not see you, but hear you.
Yeah. And Jason Diamond, how are you?
Actually really good.
So would you agree with me that NAB in Vegas isn't exactly the most relaxing weekend you could possibly have?
No, I think I've just recovered now.
It's a bit weird, isn't it? It's like a bit intense.
Yeah.
But we're here to talk about ILM's first move into fully animated feature films, the film Rango. It's been out for a little while now. We're trying to do this actually while I was in America a couple of weeks ago. And in fact, I was at ILM, but I was so jet lagged that that evening I bailed. So my apologies to you guys listening. It was absolutely 100% my fault that this got moved back to today. But we're going to catch up now. Everyone's back on deck, and particularly that I'm no longer slowing everybody down. And I guess this is an unusual film for us, being fully animated, but coming from ILM. But then I think that's what makes it kind of interesting as well. It's a film that has animation supervisors and visual effects supervisors. And as we like to do, we'll start off by finding out what the guys think about the film, and then we'll have a look at it, and also some of the approaches to capturing performance for animation. And so, Mark, why don't you lead us off, being the closest to ILM, living in California as you do.
Right in the same town.
What did you think?
That was a pretty astounding film. Now, I'm going to start by saying visually, that we're going to have a lot to talk about on the show here. And in terms of how they made it, and the more I learned about it, the more that made sense. Some of the things they did to make this a pretty unique film, which I think it was. I think it felt very different from other 3D animation films that I know of.
In a good way or a bad way?
In a good way. And specifically, one thing that I felt was going on early on, there were moments where I felt like, wow, even like stop motion animation, like we could actually do this digitally. Like some of the characters had such real presence to them, more like you'd expect with physical models, if you know what I mean.
Okay.
The quality of light on them, the details of the hair, the eyes, I mean, a lot of qualities like that. Overall, the film, you know, have you ever heard the saying that there are basically two storylines? I know some people sometimes say there are five. You ever heard the theory that there are two?
Okay, yeah, what are the two?
So the two are apparently going on a journey and a stranger comes to town.
Okay.
And in fact, this one was both, and actually it went in, it was bimodal. It started out going on a journey, then it became stranger comes to town, then it went back to going on a journey, and then there was the subtext of him needing to be in his story. So it felt like there was a little bit of a fight there, actually, about that whole topic.
But metaphorically speaking, you'd give it the thumbs up.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Now, okay, so Jason Diamond?
I would say the storyline was actually the reluctant hero's journey to from A to B, where he realizes his potential to be the hero without initially wanting to be, but not knowing he can do it, and then realizing that he can do it. I loved it. I thought it was great top to bottom. I know I say that a lot. I like a lot of movies. But I went with my kid, who is 4, and I sort of fell prey to the, it's animated, it's for kids, you know, scenario. Which is fair or not fair, really, but I think I read later that they were aiming for a 10-plus audience for kids.
Well, I have 2 children, 10 and 12. We think we should have our children, you know, like a declaration of interest at the beginning of the podcast when doing these sorts of films. And I saw it with them. Mark, did you see the film in the presence of young'uns?
No, I did not. I was out of town in Southern California and saw it Solo, and my 10-year-old daughter declared her disinterest in this film, and I don't know why, actually. Although I did guess that, to me, it felt like it was targeting even older than her from the way it was marketed and the way it looked.
Okay, so a couple of things. Firstly, you guys both did have picked up on this idea of a thematic Western, folklore that's turned into a film genre plot device. And I would say to you, apart from stylistically and the fact that there was chameleons instead of actors, did this have an original story for you guys?
I mean, I don't think it was overly original, but I think...
Did it have even any originality?
Well, yeah, the originality was the setting and the fact that they're animals, you know, looking for water instead of, you know, I know they... This is maybe early to bring this up, but I know they based it on There Will Be Blood, which was a lot, at least, you know, tonally, and that was obviously about oil. So it was about a resource that was being... managed by someone, you know, improperly, I guess, for lack of a better...
I understood that they were basing the look on There Will Be Blood, but I think the story reminded me an awful lot more of Chinatown.
Yes.
If I had to look for fingerprints on it.
With water.
I directly. Thought for the first few
you
minutes...
You had to look for those fingerprints? I thought they were fairly large fingerprints. I don't think there was anyone in the audience. Did anyone here not think that when he was searched out of town, water. Having been revealed as a fraud, that he would in fact come back, save the day, and get the girl?
No, of course. I was just waiting to see how they did it.
Well, and okay. I have to say, the going on a journey story, for the first 10 minutes or so of the film, I had no idea where we were going next, and I loved it. So, yeah. In fact,
I totally agree with it. I totally agree with that. I just feel okay. So, my declaration is: I felt that the last half of the film was incredibly predictable. Now, I don't think that the art direction was predictable. I don't think the character animation, the design, the texturing, any of that was particularly walking over well-trodden ground. In fact, I was stunned at how ugly some frames were, in the sense it lacked almost anything that you would call Disney-esque cutesy or fun. There were a couple of little sidekicky kind of characters, but generally it had a gritty, ugly, not ugly, but kind of coarse, sunburnt property to that was terrific. But plot-wise, the latter half, I was really... And therein lies the problem, I guess, is that is it a kid's film or is it aimed at adults? And I guess for me, this had absolutely all the hallmarks of the quality production of ILM without the storytelling skills of Pixar. That would be my paraphrase.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
I'm going to stick with my story that it wanted to be going on a journey and it kept feeling like it had to be Stranger Comes to Town. I think every time went on a journey, we were good.
I mean, there's a reason Pixar is Pixar, and this is ILM's first shot, and clearly they tried to buck the system and just say, listen, we're not, you know, the seasoned pros at animated storytelling, strictly animated, from a feature film perspective, and we're just going to see how it goes.
But it's not quite fair, is it, to make that comparison, since Pixar spends a few years in story development in-house, and this one was actually developed at Gore Verbinski's house in the hills above Pasadena.
Sort of
and I think this is a great coup for ILM because they really prove they can do a lot just in terms of delivering animation and laying out scenes from scratch for storytelling purposes and innovative ways to work with that. And I'd love to see them maybe get more of a chance to, Pixar has really such an advantage the way they develop films over everybody. And they've earned it over time. And ILM's just not in a position to invest that number of years, I assume, at this point.
I think ILM could do anything ILM wants to. I think that for me, this was a live action director dealing with ILM in that director-client relationship. That's fundamentally different from the in-house Pixar John Lasseter team brain trust approach, where they're putting out a film every year or so and they've got a team of seasoned directors helping another team of seasoned directors, and they all work for Pixar. And I think that if I could be so arrogant, is my guess as to why story wasn't as strong. At that end, just, you know, Disney, from the earliest Toy Story days, the original Toy Story, helped Pixar learn how to tell stories. I mean, Disney were really good at telling stories and had the foresight to shut down Toy Story 1 and fix it. As Pixar then did back to Disney on, I'm going to say, Bolt, when they shut down production and rebooted it to fix it. I don't think this was broken. I just think that this looks and is animated better than it tells stories. That's a subtle line, but I don't reckon.
But isn't it fair to say that ILM was closer to replacing the DP than the writer on this one?
Yeah. I mean, I have no inside knowledge on that. But yeah, I mean, that would feel like that, wouldn't it?
And, my understanding from the research we did is they just weren't really in on the early part, the key parts of the writing process. They got it almost more like the client services company would.
There was like 1.5 years of... There's 1.5 years of pre-pro, not particularly intense pre-pro, 20 days with the actors, and 1.5 years or 18 months to then actually make it and polish it. Well, anyway, let's stop beating them up over story, because it wasn't like it was horrendous. It just wasn't, I don't think, adventurous in the story. In other words, the storytelling didn't match the other areas, rather than saying it was a bad film or anything. And so the really interesting thing about this from a technical point of view, if we just change hats, is that when a Pixar or, for that matter, Blue Sky type film tends to be recorded, they tend to get the voice actor and they record it and they massively edit the dialogue of the individual actor to get the lines that they wanted. Here, they did this thing that they jokingly called, I think, a motion capture or something like that, mm-hmm. where they basically had the actors kind of acting out with the other actors with dumb bits of costume and kind of hokey kind of props, so that they recorded dialogue as a much more film-centric approach rather than a traditional animated approach. And that's a pretty big jump, actually. Mark, have you worked on any animated films or had that kind of dialogue editing stuff in a film that you've worked on?
No, but watching the behind the scenes of how they did it reminded me much more of how you would develop a play or do improv. They were in a room.
Yeah.
It's really loose. People stand around the edge. The people who are involved jump in the middle. They interact. They've got guys, I think they even were using handheld boom mics to just try to attract them so they could move around freely as they interacted. They didn't worry about getting, you know, they didn't worry about overlapping dialogue for the most part. I think they took a clean track probably if they needed it, but they let it be like that. They let things come out of just having them be actors. I mean, I think it was kind of cool in the sense of actually how stripped down to what I think of as kind of the base level of acting they were doing. Like, it was less antiseptic than the recording booth might be otherwise.
And it felt lensed to me as if it was a live action piece. I mean, it had a much more live action lensing and staging than it did, than, like, I mean, it just really felt, obviously there were animated characters, but, you know, it felt like it was, there was a realism to the way that it kind of got lensed. What do you think, Jess?
I think that is the function of Gore Verbinski being a live action director and wanting to interact with his talent all at once. Like, he would block. You know, it was like active blocking, basically. And even though ILM didn't specifically use they weren't using the video that they were recording for reference. I think, like in your interview with Hal Hickel, he said that, you know, looking and seeing the guy who wasn't delivering a line standing in the background giving a face helps the animator more, because they have to think of all that stuff. And that sitting and looking at that blank canvas and having to add 10 characters in the background can be daunting. And I think that also, you know, I saw on the behind the scenes thing, they had like Johnny Depp burst through like a half set of the saloon so he could push through the doors. And I think it gives a physicality to their breathing and to their motions, and it makes it feel more real. I think Wes Anderson did the same thing for Fantastic Mr. Fox. And I think it totally works. Not that, obviously, booth recording works great. I mean, tons of great animated films that you wouldn't even bother to think about how they recorded it. But did anyone see what camera they were shooting on? I know it's completely irrelevant, but I was just looking in the behind the scenes. I could never get a clear look at the camera.
At the domestic camera that was
reference camera.
I don't know, but I imagined it was just something pretty small.
I only saw that it was HD. I didn't really.
I mean, the thing is that this is blocked out on a scene basis, not on a shot basis, right? This isn't like an effects house doing a shot. This is an effects house doing a sequence. But then, I mean, let's face it. If you look at Avatar, isn't Avatar a whole bunch of animated short films joined by a couple of bits of live action all done in 3D? I mean, those sequences are fully animated. I mean, Star Wars, their entire sequences are obviously fully animated. I mean, it's not as if ILM's never done this before.
But, well, they've never gone, you know, line to line, scene to scene, you know, full feature, you know, where everything is connected.
Yeah, but I mean, at the end of the third being the sixth Star Wars film, there are massive sequences that have like tiny amounts of actual live action in them with fights and stuff. I mean, you know, that there are clones and they cut and cut and cut. And I mean, I think that that made it look good. I think that these guys know what they're doing, and I don't think it's as big a jump as it was back in the day. There was talk of ILM coming out with Frankenstein, which was a project that ILM was going to helm as a fully animated feature years ago. I remember hearing about this in the kind of a whisper uttered in corridors. And so by the time we get to today, doing a film with, you know, 1,200 shots or 1,500 shots, I mean, you could produce an entire feature film that only has that number of cuts and every shot's
It wasn't surprising. So, when they said that they were going to do it, it was actually exciting.
So what did you actually think of the character design, guys? So, like, let's assume that ILM can lens it and craft it and do it, and obviously they can render it. What do we actually think of that? Because it's a pretty unusual character, a chameleon. I mean, the eyes in particular, but just the sort of absence of big cutesy eyes.
I loved all the character design. My favorite character was Spoons, the little weirdo, dirty Ewok guy, even though I think he was like a rabbit or something. I don't even know what he was, but I just remember looking at him and being like, that's my guy. Like, you know, sort of that. I like, that's the guy that I'm going to watch the whole time. I liked how they were dirty and gross and like real. You know what I mean? They were like, they live in the desert. You know, they have no water. They can't. They're animals. They don't bathe, you know.
Well, some of them. When I made the comment about there being this kind of photographic stop-motion reality to some of them when they appeared, specifically Beans and Priscilla were two of the characters that felt like that to me. I think the Johnny Depp character, the Rango character, succeeded remarkably well given that, man, I mean, they had to work with this really wide mouth and these tiny little eyes. And, of course, they did do something really daring with the eyes, right? By actually having, you know, not basically doing the classic kind of cartoon eyes and doing more like, I think, the kind of eyes that Pixar's been doing for a while with creature work in naturalistic films, right? Then there were other characters that I had more trouble with, and I think the problem I had, first of all, I didn't really feel like this world was at teeny scale, even though I think you were supposed to read it that way. I forgot that they're all their sort of animal size, and I mean, obviously they weren't paying a lot of worry to relative scale of various creatures or whatever, but because I wasn't thinking about them small scale, perhaps, or maybe it was just what they actually had to do for some of the mouth movement versus the character designs, I had trouble with some of the characters that had thicker skin, like Rattlesnake Jake. I had kind of the Jabba the Hutt problem a little bit, where it was so, you know, like the physical reality of it was good enough that it took me out of it to not buy that his mouth would actually move like that and pronounce those words that way. Especially since other characters I had no problem with. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it does. I mean, because they did. They sort of gave up on scale at some point that was like, you know, they went from the bottle and the stuff in the desert. I mean, I think that there was a big change in the film, though it's subtle when you're watching it, between pre-coming to town and town. Because pre-coming to town was, in some respects, a more sparse and perhaps stylistically interesting film. The opening sequence with the inside the fish tanky thing that wasn't really a water tank but like a habitat. And then that smashing on the ground and then him out in the desert and all of that was accurate to scale and playing on those gags. Once they get into town, it was almost like they then sort of said, let's not go with that because it'll just get in the way of the story and we'll just go with it. And
yeah, what's more, you had to buy the heavy characters as being big and threatening and heavy. They had to feel big and heavy. Like Rattlesnake Jake had to feel much bigger than a rattlesnake.
Yeah, and in terms of character design, I think Rango himself was much more successful than the rattlesnake. The rattlesnake, to me, looked more cartoonesque and less quirky and, I don't know, for some reason the snake just was like one notch down on realism, one notch up on cartoony kind of...
Well, the machine gun tail, it's going to throw them over. You know, all the other animals were animals with, they're people-esque animals. So that guy's the drunk, that guy's the... the bad, heavy guy. But they were all their animals. None of them had a hook or something, you know. And when he comes in with the machine gun tail, it takes you out of their reality a little bit.
Yeah, that's what I thought, certainly. But I applaud the fact that most of the characters were phenomenally complex, interesting, and unusual, and not stylistically an obvious way to go.
Can I just say that it was when they do the fight and do the trench run.
Yeah,
in my brain, I just said, "Oh right, ILM cannot resist a good trench run sequence." it's just going to be perennially in every film they make because it works. It's a great device, and it was great. So,
yeah, I found it to be the least interesting in terms of emotional engagement.
It was just a fun, let's get some action, let's get some new characters in there and, you know, tension, go. I mean, it wasn't perfect, but I liked it.
Okay. Well, I think that they also had a huge amount of really effective particle work in this. So we get away from the characters now. Like, if you just looked at it from an effects point of view, I know it's an animated film, the animation effects in this just really had ILM's DNA all over them.
Mm-hmm.
The dust clouds, the... I don't know. What do you guys think? Did the water sims hold up?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was aware of them as I was watching them and thinking, well, you know, ILM's been good at water for a while now, and now they get to have some fun with it. So I thought, especially in the end when the whole town gets flooded in this really stylistic way, like that, you know, they got to play.
What about you, Justin?
I really liked the Sims when they were the water when they were in the jug. I thought that it worked really well for the displacement and refraction and sort of everything. It just felt super real. And I also liked the fact that the lighting was in the outdoor sequences was basically the sun for all intents and purposes. I mean, they made a sun, let it like sort of globally illuminate the scene and then waited to see what happened, where stuff bounced and all. And then, you know, lit from there, which I think gave it more of a realistic feel as well. 'Cause that you get all the particulates and everything sort of coming up from under their feet and the interactions of the characters, and massive lens flares from a real sun type lens flare.
Yeah. I think that, I wasn't aware when I watched it, but I think that, from what I've read, that ILM moved heavily, both in the San Fran office and the Singapore office, to doing a lot of stuff with GPUs on this. So they were actually using a ton of GPU accelerated processors for the, because you know they have this Plume, a proprietary solver. I think it's also a renderer, but it's a GPU accelerated solver, and they were using it like on Harry Potter and stuff, and I think a couple of other films. Anyway, Last Airbender actually had really good water in it at the end when there was that huge effect sequence. Well, the whole thing was a huge effect sequence, but at the end of that. And I think that their GPU acceleration and getting a whole lot of real-time feedback on the dust and fire would have made it, like, just little things, like when they're riding on those, whatever they were, chickens or whatever, and stuff, like there's just a lot of detailed stuff happening with feathers and hair and dust, and I think it just made stuff really, really good. And the fact that they could get that done, I believe, about 100 times faster than they could before it was GPU accelerated,
wow,
really makes a huge difference. Actually, to go into a bit of a rat hole, you've been at ILM many times, I assume, Mark, but have you been down to the render room downstairs much?
No.
So if you go down to the render farm at ILM, which I did for a second, I've been there before, but I hadn't been there for like a few years. And, you know, they moved to the Presidio. They obviously set up this huge render space downstairs for the farm. And they actually built something twice as large and then halved it with a wall, expecting that 3 years from now they'd knock down the wall and just extend it out. Because if you drew a graph on paper, render farms are getting bigger and bigger and they just look like no end in sight. Well, that happened. But in fact, the render farms firstly got to blade servers and then more compressed. So what they ended up doing is having less of them but more space around them to let airflow go around them to cool them. And then they even went down in terms of power consumption and heat consumption. So they never knocked the wall out. So ILM's render farm, while continuing to grow, is in the same kind of space that it was before. But it's that, and then you go to GPUs, and then you get this whole other pickup. So the technology actually didn't even go the way ILM expected it to, which was they expected to scale out, and they actually sort of just got cleverer and cleverer hubs, and now, of course, faster and faster GPU-accelerated stuff. You know, a huge render farm, but actually walking around it seems remarkably modest and small, given that that's the farm for the whole company, and they can run, what, four or five, maybe six major features through there at one time. So they obviously don't have any problem with doing that because they deliver on the goods, but it's an astonishing feat to be able to get these kind of things through, because on any other facility, putting a Rango through or something like that would just basically choke the farm. But obviously, ILM has a really hell of a good bunch of guys in the IT department.
Well, and it wasn't a stereo film, so they only had to do half as much rendering.
Actually, something else that I heard ages ago, and I think it's still true today, which is that whenever you go home at night, every computer in the place, from the accountant's to the receptionist's computer, goes into the farm. So no matter where you are in the building, it's rendering. So I guess it's not just the computers down in the vault down there at the bottom of the Presidio, but elsewhere. So I think that if you've got a lot of compute power and you can really, you know, deliver on it, then you can afford to plus out the film. And I reckon the effects stuff in this, the GPU stuff that they put in there, really plussed it out. Because I had no problem with production value on this film. I didn't feel ripped off. I didn't feel it was small.
That was beautiful.
It had lighting. It had staging. It had everything. I say minor criticism, the story was a bit obvious. But then it gets back to the central question as to who the heck this film was aimed at. Because that, I think, is a bit of a problem these days with animated films, because you kind of want to say everyone, and that's not a very good way to go in terms of setting them up. And I guess the director and one of the principal actors are coming from Pirates, which has somewhat of a similar problem. I mean, do we feel like this film knew its audience?
Well, I had the same concern, and I assumed it had been kind of obscure. And actually, am I right that it didn't get a stereo? It didn't get a stereo release anywhere, did it? Yeah.
No, and I actually applauded that when I realized that, because thank God.
Right, but that's a sign of for a film made in 3D to refuse to have a stereo release is definitely speaking to a kind of artistic integrity, if you will, that might not be a studio executive's first choice of how to raise box office, particularly when they can charge more for tickets for a stereo film. I think this film actually did, kind of like Pirates, actually did surprisingly well for how quirky it is, right? I mean, I'm trying to actually look up the numbers right now, but when I looked at it at the time I saw it, I was really surprised at the kind of numbers they'd gotten. Now, I know we're not supposed to be like box office pundits here, which is part of the reason I didn't bother to look this up beforehand. So if you give me a second, I can probably nail it down. But it seems like they took a risk and they actually kind of got there.
I mean, if you look at Gore Verbinski's first movie, Mouse Hunt, it sort of has the same problem. Like, it's sort of a Home Alone Tom and Jerry movie, but it's also, it's pretty dark. You know what I mean? And I was actually watching it with my kid the other day, and he loved it, but it's, you know, it's violent, and even though it's over-the-top violence, and there's really weird themes going through the film, and that's actually my favorite Gore Verbinski movie until Rango. And Rango had a similar thing, where it had these weird esoteric themes running through it and the Hunter S. Thompson stuff. But then, you know, like, I had no sort of, I saw the trailer and that was it. And I was like, oh, great. I didn't even look at the rating. Like I said, I said, oh, great. I'll go to it with my kid. He'll love it. We'll have a great time. And I'll be stoked to see an ILM animated feature. And watching it, like I said, he's four. He wasn't scared and he was totally into it. And there's obviously tons of the film that went right over his head. But I was surprised at how dark it was, especially with the Rattlesnake Jake telling characters that he was going to take him to hell and rip him apart, you know, which was like, I was like, oh, okay. I look at my kid and he was like, yeah, this is awesome, you know. But there were little kids in the theater that were crying and parents were leaving with their kids. And I think people had the same sort of take, like, oh, wait, it's for older kids, but it's also for the adults, but not in a, like, nod and a wink joke, here, you can have some fun too kind of way.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I think Gore, obviously, he's very very young. He's only, a year older than me, so he's obviously incredibly young. you know, I think that he did a brilliant job on Pirates of the Caribbean, and there are other good films like The Mexican and stuff, but I think the first Pirates of the Caribbean was, like, great. I mean, really, really good. Third one was a bit, you know, what the? But, you know, wait to see. I think the fourth one looks... the way that the trajectory is going on that franchise is kind of interesting. But I think this film was successful. Don't get me wrong. I do think it was successful. I don't think it knew its audience quite well enough. I don't think the story engaged me enough to go for an older teen. And certainly... But I think, you know, at the end of the day, what made this film as successful as it was, and I've got about 120 million mark on my
that's the domestic, and then I'm seeing 200, about double that worldwide.
Yeah, so obviously successful. I think what made it is just that it was beautiful in an ugly world. It was beautiful ugly. And I think that's an achievement because, you know, we often, in the early days of computer graphics, used to complain so much that things didn't look real, they didn't look dry, they didn't look scuffed, they didn't look dirty. And this film is just everything that early CG films weren't. I mean, is there any part of this that looks polished? I don't, apart from maybe the fish in the fish tank that he's hugging on the poster. Everything else is just really... really well textured.
Did you guys feel that the style might have moved around a bit? That although this movie definitely had a defined style, that there were some shots that felt maybe like they could be in a completely different movie?
What would that be?
Well, like, for example, it seemed like there were moments where I just felt like, and, you know, I wanted this and I expected it, but it was like, hey, we're going to show off now and give you a night exterior that is completely naturalistic, right?
Yeah, I think that is difficult. I guess I don't know if I felt like it was a different film.
Mm-hmm.
I was didn't really mean conscious like when they had the shots of, but I mean stylistically.
Yeah,
I was really conscious of that shot of Vegas when they had the looking over the hill at Vegas. That really felt like, oh, what's that? Oh, okay, we've just, you know. It's one thing for my favorite characters, which my favorite characters, well, do you want to guess what my favorite characters were by far?
The turtle?
No. Gentlemen. The Al Mariachi Band.
Oh, right, yeah.
Oh, my God. That was just phenomenal. I'd take an entire film with those guys.
Yeah.
But, you may get that. Yeah. I just say bring him back. Yeah, so the Vegas stuff looked kind of different.
I think it stylistically served the story that it did, though, right? Because...
Yeah, different world.
Yeah.
But it didn't... We sort of looked down on it, which is an odd thing, because you obviously had to look down on it, mm-hmm. but that's that scale thing. For me, I expected to look... To sort of discover Vegas as this big up thing, not look down on a little Vegas.
Right. I was going to say, the only thing that actually I didn't like, and it's just a matter of it's just not something that's been solved yet, was the Clint Eastwood... I love the Clint Eastwood aspect of it, but the human animation was just... I had been looking at these human animals for the whole movie, and then you see a real human at this giant scale, and it just... The facial animation was still just like, oh, it's CG face.
If they had actually done Frankenstein, there would have been a lot of those, I think. I was actually I auditioned to be scratch voiceover talent on Frankenstein, and I got a look at that one in development, which I think one can now, right? But it was definitely going to be more naturalistic characters. I kind of, though, would love to see ILM do something that's not talking animals. Maybe not necessarily human characters like that, but... again, I think the stylist...
Do you guys remember a work in progress? From
some SIGGRAPH?
Mid-2000-y SIGGRAPH time. Yeah, it was a short film that ILM did that was whacked out on Scooby Snacks. I mean, it really was.
Yeah, I remember that.
Somebody was just tripping.
Yeah. I thought they were going to make that a feature.
But that did come out of the Frankenstein experiment, I think. I think that's what they managed to rescue out of it. Yeah.
Did you think that, I mean...
Well, I mean, I think that's the thing. That's where I was going with this slight tangent, in that human characters, all human characters, CG, you know, maybe there's another way that would actually be just as fun as this one without being talking animals and not be all Clint Eastwood. Like, that's what I'd like to see.
Yeah, but did we think... Because I was... You stole my joke. I had this terrific the giant Clint in the room. But did you think that Clint suddenly appeared? Well, firstly, did you think it was Clint Eastwood?
No, I knew it was Timothy Oliphant. I sort of pride myself on my ability to pick out voice actors. But
that's impressive.
But it was good. I mean, I assume they didn't get him to do it just right off the bat. I just cut him out. It's not going to be really Clint. Who's it going to be? And then, but it was great. I like the concept of it. It's just as soon as you see the face, you're like, ugh. And it's nobody's fault. I mean, just nobody can do it yet. But that's sort of, I don't know. I can't really say much more about it. But I like conceptually, I loved it. With the sort of, you know, it's had like a Bob Hope vibe, you know, so like the golf cart with the Oscars in it and stuff was like,
They look like advertising awards in the back, not Oscars.
Were they? Clio's?
They look like a Clio to me. But anyway, what did you think, Mark? What did you think of Clint?
I thought he was cool when he was just the figure off in the distance, when he had still the mystery. And yeah, maybe they should have kept him under the brim of his hat a little bit more. I didn't think it was really Clint. The voice timbre was a little lighter, but it was cool. You know, it conjured. I mean, I didn't really think it was really Hunter S. Thompson at the beginning of the film either, because he's dead. But it didn't take away from me enjoying that was in there.
So do we think that there would be legs in a Rango sequel?
Ooh,
I don't think it would be necessary, honestly. Unless you did like a spin-off of one of the characters or something, you know.
The Mariachi Band.
The only other thing that bothered me was that I also knew that the main Mariachi Band, the guy who spoke the most, the leader, is a voiceover guy who does like all these American commercials and TV ads and stuff, or promos and stuff. So I was, it sort of bothered me because his voice is too pro for me versus everybody else. But that's just a voice thing. That animation was great.
You just have too much audio skills, my friend.
I do. It's horrible. But ask my wife. She's like, stop. Okay, I don't care. You know. We haven't brought this up yet when you were talking about the lensing thing, but the fact that they chose Roger Deakins as their DOP, you know, du jour to advisor. Give his advising was, I mean, who else could you get? I mean,
did Deakins consult Pixar on WALL-E? I think he did.
I can't remember.
Because there's a lot of subtlety in that kind of lensing it. For example, not doing a nodal pan when you do a pan of the camera, because the lens would, in fact, mounted on a tripod, not be, you know, right over the central access point for the turn kind of thing. That that really adds a reality and a weight to stuff.
You're
and
correct I know Deakin, about that, by the way.
Was Deakins? Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I know that I was stunned from the trailer of WALL-E, how well it looked like it was lensed and set up. There's a bit where some shopping carts fall down and go down some stairs, and WALL-E tries to get out of the way and it all gets slammed, and there's like, I think, a focus pull, and they might miss it on the zoom or the pan, and like just everything about that shot screamed that somebody really understood real cameras, and not in a kind of Battlestar Galactica way of we're gonna, you know, not find it with the hunting seeking zoom so many times that you'd want to fire the cameraman. Not that I want to be flamed by Battlestar Galactica fans, but after we got that gag, it did get a bit like, can you get some better virtual cinematographers? and not certainly in the way that we did with Bourne Ultimatum, where, you know, you felt that the DOP was made to look like he had ADD because it was so jerky and bouncy. No, I thought the lensing was really good. And I wonder, though, you know, at what point... Because Deakins is consulting. He's not actually working as the DOP, is he?
Right.
I'm pretty sure.
But you still get his eyes.
Yeah.
Which is really what you want.
Yeah. Must be really interesting for him. I'd love to interview him if I could ever do that. Because I think it would be fascinating to know how far he goes into the computer side of things versus how much he just says, this is what it's like in real life, and you guys work it out after that.
Yeah. Because, I mean, the lighting in the bar, when Rango first walks into the bar and it's the sort of Kaiser Soze picking his name, you know, bit.
Yeah.
I feel like that the lighting in that scene is ridiculous. The way everyone steps in and out of shadow, but you can completely see all the detail and you get the particulates, and that screamed a real DOP gave his eyeballs to that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. That's though I wonder again, so that's okay, we talked about DOP in terms of lensing, but do you think it was DOP in terms of lighting? Because obviously the main thing a director of photography does is light a scene rather than be the camera operator. We're making it sound like the DOP is the camera operator. They can be, but they obviously don't need to be. Do you feel like...
In an animated film, I would imagine it's probably a little bit of both, since he can they can't actually operate or give operating notes, and you're not... You're still another person is still decoding what you want, but it's different than a physical. I don't know. I guess it's probably the same.
Well, there's also just normally bring him in during the storyboarding phase, since you have complete control thereafter over how you're going to set up your shots. And if you have this mandate, like these guys did from the director, to get good reaction shots from characters, which is something that isn't always done in animated films, so you get, you know, the shots of people listening, you get the kind of, you know, elegant shots where you can get a reaction with a focus pull and so on. And I guess they did have this avatar-like rig, right? Did you guys see this behind the scenes where they had sort of a virtual camera that they could take down to a little stage in ILM and point around? And I didn't really know if that was for the director or the...
saw that. I didn't realize that they did that. And was that just for Gore Verbinski for like just for general like blocking purposes? Like, okay, well, we're going to face this way because the saloon's over here and the street's down there, or did they capture that data?
Yeah, I don't know if any of us knows.
Yeah, I certainly don't know. I think I just want to do one thing, though. I do think that the process, the emotion capture, the idea of doing this stuff, you know, on a stage and blocking it and stuff, it's probably the most direct translation of me feeling, I don't know if it's true, that the performance of Johnny Depp was a really valid Johnny Depp performance, albeit translated into a chameleon. You know, like there are animated films where you've got a voice talent, like John Cleese doing something in something, and you say, well, it's John Cleese's voice, but I really don't feel like there's anything Cleese-esque in the performance of the king in Shrek. And so, or Julianne, I think it's Julie Andrews, or somebody is his wife, and it just feels like they're just buying name actors for their names, but really, but this did feel like, I think Johnny Depp really deserved to have his name big up on the poster, and I feel like it really felt quirky, and from what we've seen, he gave a lot of those kind of nuanced performance stuff that then got through to the final film. So it's, albeit not motion capture, it's a pretty good translation of an actor's craft to an actor's on-screen presence, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, they can say that they weren't using it as a, you know, we don't use this as a direct animation reference, but you're looking at Johnny Depp giving a physical performance as if he were acting in front of a camera, you know, for camera purposes. And how could you not take cue from, you know, he makes these big, wide, goofy steps, or he thrusts his chest out, or makes a head movement or something. I mean, it seems like you would want to add in as much of that as is needed to sell the Johnny Deppness of the performance.
So, Mark, you're going to direct an animated feature film. I have $50 million lying around. I've got nothing to do with it, so I'm going to give it to you to make an animated feature. Would you approach your performance with your cast this way?
You mean in the way that this one was done?
Yeah, you're not allowed to run off with the $50 million, by the way.
When I first saw the posters and promos for this film, I actually thought it was... I actually must have been... inspired by Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. So I might look for another old Terry Gilliam film that I could raid the cast of and bring back to life. You know, that one had Johnny Depp in it. But I think I'm wrong about that. Okay, $50 million. And would I approach it... You know, if I wanted to have fun, I would definitely do what these guys did, which is hole up in the house with my friends and, you know, do a bunch of story sessions and then actually make it also in this really loose way. If I wanted to be assured of making a really good movie, I would probably submit it to the story grinder that Pixar uses if I had that available. And I would trust in that process of completely ripping it apart and building it back up. And I don't think that happened on this film. I think they, you know, I think Gore Verbinski's in a great position to kind of do what he wanted on this one. And I think it's cool that it paid off. But the feelings that we're all voicing in different ways about the story that it, and the story itself voiced, like the story itself was speaking for the story, right? Like the role of the Clint Eastwood character was to tell him to get back in the story. It was kind of funny. So that, you know, that probably would be the thing that I would focus on changing. But if I did that, then I'd have to face a lot more rewrites and maybe even failure.
Jason, if you were hired in Mark's $50 million film, do you want clean voice stuff? Or do you think that if you're an animator, you'd want to be translating Depp's performance? Because, I mean, I actually think that actors are great actors, but I think animators are great actors too.
No, absolutely. You know, the I think I said this in an older show. You know, Toy Story 3 was nominated for Best Picture. They could have nominated the guy who animated Woody and for Best Leading Actor, you know, because he's creating the performance, especially since they do that all just dudes in a booth. So I mean, yeah, I think your animators are
Tom Hanks, right?
Yeah, the guy, you know, whatever.
That guy.
That guy. You know, they're all just dudes. dudes with money. But the I agree with you 100% that I would prefer to have the mix of a great actor and a great animating actor, for lack of a better term, animator, as a combo. And I prefer the sort of physicality that comes out of performing the action while you are saying the line, because I think it changes your delivery. Even though you may deliver it exactly the same way tonally, I think your arms moving and all that other kind of stuff changes the physicality of the recording. And I don't mind overlapping dialogue, because worst case scenario is you go back and you ADR a couple lines that you would have to do in a real feature. So, I mean, it's not like it's never been done before.
That's true. One of the things that we got from that interview that I did for FX Guide on the film is that they actually cut up the video. So the animators actually had the video, even if they jumped performances, like they went for take one up to a certain point and then picked up take two on the dialogue, they'd cut the video to match. So the animators actually had that as a like a video little movie. Quick time, I guess, to watch vis-a-vis what was going on, which I think is pretty interesting.
And for master sync, like master lip sync, just for checking, like, right? Not for matching, but, oh, I just need to double check. Oh, yeah, his mouth closes there. Great. That's it, you know.
Well, but also expressions and little eye movements, all that stuff.
And you've got to think that even though they tend to do that with traditional stuff where they film the actors delivering the lines, as you've seen in many making-ofs, that you would get a better performance if the actor didn't feel constrained to leave their head in close proximity to the microphone the way you do when you're recording audio in a sound booth versus if you're bouncing around in a studio space and you've got a wireless mic or a boom mic over your head, and that's giving you a physicality and a freedom that you would otherwise not have. So I definitely think it's a really interesting thing that they went down this path. I think that ILM totally delivered on the visual effects as much as they did the character animation. And yet, to a certain extent, I think they've been doing animated films for years. It's just they haven't sort of done a fully animated film, so it's probably no surprise there. I'd love to see an in-house supervisor, one of the greats at ILM, direct a film with people that they've been working with at ILM for years. Nothing against Gore, who is obviously a very accomplished director, but I would have been more interested in this film, and I think it was a success, but if you told me that this was Dennis Muren or John Knowles or any of those guys at ILM actually directing this,
mm-hmm.
Then I would have been even more interested. Maybe that's just me, but I would love to see one of the in-house guys, directing it. And that they know everybody, they've been there for years, and they're really respected in the community. And I don't see why that couldn't happen, quite frankly.
Well, I mean, now that they have one under their belt, I think they probably needed a Hollywood guy to come in there, like a director, to come in to sort of kick off the process. And now they're like, oh, yeah, we could totally do this. And now they could do it themselves.
Well, but it's worth asking. I mean, they do have a film company that could produce it, but is it going to happen?
Well, you know, I mean, there are lots of really good things that get caught up in weird kind of places for ridiculously long amounts of time, and you kind of can't quite work out why that is.
Well, but I mean, what I'm saying is Lucasfilm could go into the business of producing on ILM's behalf an animated feature.
Yeah.
All the pieces are in place.
They have quite a lot of contacts, apparently.
Well, and they and a lot of money. Even if Lucas shaved off 50 mil, he wouldn't feel it. You know what I mean? To make another animated movie. I mean, it's just...
Do you want to know what the budget was on this? Because I reckon it was more than 50.
It was 135, according to...
Yeah,
when
I was pulling a number out of my ass.
So,
yeah.
I mean, when...
So they make an indie film for 50.
All right. Well, look, it's been fun talking to you guys. We've got some great shows coming up in the VFX show coming up. We've got Thor. We've got a bunch of stuff to do with some what we call... our historical or retro shows, so that includes things like AI and Poltergeist and stuff. We're going to be looking at Source Code. I've got to say, guys, some of these films have the wackiest release schedules. We got Thor this week. I don't think you guys got it for like 3 weeks. We've not got Source Code yet in Australia, and you've had it for like weeks, and no matter how hard I tried to see it in San Fran, that didn't work. But yeah, notwithstanding the weird scheduling and my inability to get in front of a microphone, which delayed this podcast, we have some great shows coming up, so... Stay tuned to that. Of course, they're all on FX Guide. Mark, what are you up to and where can people track you down?
Ooh, well, I have something kind of exciting to announce, but I think it's a little early, so I'm going to have to wait for a future podcast for the big one. I am doing a really great course with you guys at PhD, though, which people should check out. That's just getting underway, and I've had the opportunity to work with a local post-production house. Entropic adopted this independent 20-minute film, which is using kind of the Neil Blomkamp model of making the really cool short version with hundreds of visual effects shots in it, and then whetting everyone's appetite to see what the full length might be with this great young director doing it. So I think we've incited a lot of interest just because the elements and the art direction on it are really strong. It's a real treat to work on it. So I'm really happy to be doing that with you guys.
Brilliant. Now, Jason, I don't think we can discuss what you may be doing for in a couple of weeks' time, but I wish we could. But I can tell you off the record that I know what Jason is going to be possibly doing, and it's awesome, so much so that I offered to fly over to carry his bags for him to New York.
No, that's Mark's job since he works out so much.
Where can people track you down and connect up with you?
The Twitters, Jason Diamond, or my website with my brother. We do have the diamondbrothers.com, which is being sort of created now, and our production company, mbsproductions.com, like monkeys buy shoes, sort of.
How is the brothers thing different from that?
That's just going to be just directing stuff, whereas the MBS is like the full production company, and look at all the blah, blah, blah services we do. This is just going to be, hey, hire us as directors. Here's what we've directed. You know, it's just a cleaner delivery.
Because you have, of course, directed a lot of stuff, including music videos and other stuff and indie productions. So
we're actually tomorrow, I don't know if this is going to be posted, but this week we're going to be directing the main title sequence for New York Inc., which is a American spinoff of the Miami and LA Inc. series. So that's going to be really fun.
Cool. Excellent. Well, thanks so much, guys, for being with us. We really do appreciate it. I think actually one of you guys is scheduled to come back on Source Code. So terrific. We'll talk to you then. Mark, thanks so much for doing this. It's incredibly hard to coordinate this, guys. Not least of which because we actually literally have me in Sydney, Mark in West Coast, and Jason in the East Coast. So we do appreciate you guys staying up late and doing things. Until next time, we are out of here. Thanks so much for listening. See you.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com.